You know, it's hard to think of a story on any subject that hasn't involved China lately. We're obsessed with China. China this, China that, China everything. And whether you believe it was our government stimulus package that helped us avoid a recession or the continued mining boom, we have to look at our current and future prosperity through the prism of China. And there are signs that Chinese economy is starting to slow, and we've got to wonder how long we can keep relying on China for economic growth. Now, there's still a lot, a hell of a lot, we don't know about China's financial sector, especially its colossal banking sector. And I'm told their conduct makes pre-Wall Street or pre-GFC Wall Street look like a model of transparency. From London, Linda Yu, fellow in economics at Oxford, senior fellow at the London Business School, and sitting with me here in the studio, LNL regular, risk consultant and multi-talented author, Sajid Das. Welcome to the program. Linda, rumours, murmurs of a slowdown in China's economy. Can you quantify that?
I think China is going to slow for the rest of the year, and that would be consistent with what the government has been trying to do. So at the moment, growth in the first half of the year exceeds 10% year on year, but this is probably too fast in that it's generating very strong liquidity flows, which is causing possible asset bubbles in housing and the stock market. So the Chinese target growth rate for the year is about 8%, possibly 9%. So to achieve that, the government has tightened on a number of policies, and I think that's why it's actually good news that it's working and the Chinese economy is slowing to a more sustainable pace for the rest of the year.
Linda, tell us how China dealt with the GFC. There was, of course, an enormous stimulus package. How was it shaped and structured?
The stimulus package in China was absolutely huge. It was nearly the size of the U.S. stimulus, even though China is only one-third the size of the U.S. economy. It was predominantly geared towards public works infrastructure. So the benefit of doing that is that it can be implemented fairly quickly in China because there are no planning restrictions and a lot of the big transport projects were already in place. And also it was very much geared towards job creation. So a lot of the workers who were laid off from exporting factories were reabsorbed fairly quickly into new areas of employment for as part of these stimulus plans. But I think the main reason that China escaped the worst effects of the global financial crisis is that it didn't have a financial crisis of its own. Its banks were creditors of Lehman Brothers, so they lost some money, but they didn't have the kind of impairments, the kind of bad debts that are continuing to plague Western banks. So government stimulus made up for the collapse in exports in the aftermath of the crisis, and China's planning to sustain this through March of next year because they don't expect that exports are going to pick up for the rest of this year.
Das, I'd like you to tell the listener that extraordinary story about your friend who runs a state-owned enterprise in China whose company was told to buy 700 cars.
Oh, it's a rather funny story because in China, as Linda quite correctly points out, is you effectively have an economy which is not like a normal market-driven economy. So people are told to do things and the Central Committee, the Politburo and the government have huge control. So he's basically the chief financial officer. And he said to me, I'm building a car park. I said, that's very good. Why are you building a car park? He said, I have 700 cars. I said, why do you have 700 cars? He said, well, I've been told to buy 700 cars. And I said, well, do you need 700 cars? He said, no, not that I'm aware of.
Now, I raise that, and I'm glad you told the story, because, of course, in this country, we are harangued by Abbott about misspending on insulation bats, and a couple of schools have complained about their halls. Are you saying that there's been a lot of waste in China?
Well, I think Linda touched on the fact that the stimulus package was designed to create employment. And the Chinese were really concerned about a simple factor, which is their growth rates is geared to absorbing a certain number of people who come into the workforce. And when the GFC hit, roughly 20 million people, and these are guest workers which come from Western and other parts of China to Guangzhou mainly, and the Eastern Seaboard to work in export-driven industries, they were laid off. And that caused huge problems, and there were riots and so forth. So the Chinese government wanted to basically make sure they were employed. And so what they did was pump money into all the critical heavy industries to employ them. And to do that, they produced things, but then the problem was, what the hell are we going to do with them? So they also arranged on the other side, as you can do in a command economy, for somebody to buy them. So it was wonderful.
Boning up for this story, I was astonished to learn that by market capitalization, China has now three of the four largest banks, the two largest insurance companies, the second largest stock market, and a lengthy list of investment funds. This has only taken a couple of years.
Well, that's actually quite remarkable. That's happened in actually since 2004. So in the last 6 years, that's happened. But I think it's a bit misleading, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, when you look at the major Chinese banks, there's four of them: Bank of China, China Construction Bank, Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, and now the Agricultural Bank of China. Now, if you look at all four of them, they're substantially, like three-quarters, owned by the government. So what people do is take the shares that are trading, which is a small part, and scale that up to their market capitalization or their market value in share terms. In reality, they're probably not as worth as much.
But let's look at the Agricultural Bank of China. That's the last of the five big state-owned banks to float. It's got 320 million customers, 500,000 staff, and more branches than many a Wall Street firm has desks.
You're absolutely correct. It's quite an extraordinary thing. They have 441,000 staff, as you said. To give you some comparison, the Commonwealth Bank in Australia employs 44,000 people. Now, the Agricultural Bank of China has 24,000 branches compared to 1,000. And their balance sheet is, I think from memory, about $1.2 trillion, which is about the size of the entire Australian economy. But you're talking about a bigger country.
Linda, tell us a bit about how these ginormous banks operate. How involved is the Communist Party? Does it effectively dominate all of them?
It does. These state-owned banks are exactly that. They call them state-owned commercial banks because they do have a portion which is owned by private investors. So this is either the traded portion or the minority equity holders, which are invested, mostly Western banks actually, which are invested in these banks. But these banks are controlled by the Chinese government. They're told to operate on commercial terms, but it's very vague as to whether or not they really do. And in fact, I think if you look at the operation of the financing of the government stimulus, it's quite clear that these banks still do the government's bidding. So in other words, the Chinese state is very decentralized. So the central government only takes in about a quarter of the revenue base of the country. So they only finance that much of the stimulus. So the rest of it was financed by these big state-owned commercial banks. And they essentially did what they were told to, which is to finance the stimulus and hit a credit target this year of about $1.1 trillion. And that equates to a money expansion of about 17%. It's very hard to imagine any other country which could actually do that. Governments normally don't just tell banks to finance their borrowing in order to stimulate the economy. But because of China's mixed state and market, that's exactly what's happened. And I think that's pretty informative about how the banks operate in other areas as well.
Well, Linda, it explains why when things go wrong in Chinese banks, the governments bail them out. And I see that since 1998, it's injected the equivalent of $400 billion into the five biggest banks alone.
Yes, and I think this is one of the reasons why I find it slightly worrisome that some of the biggest banks in the world are now the Chinese banks, because state-owned banks always have this moral hazard problem. They are owned by the state, they're financed by the state, they tend to be very inefficient. And I think the recapitalization of these banks is very telling in that the government is very keen that these banks are viewed as competitive and profitable because they need a stable banking system to support their economic growth. But there's also a huge amount of legacy non-performing bad debts in these state-owned banks, which had been disposed of in part through government measures to create bad banks that took them off the balance sheets of these banks about a decade ago. And the continuing injection of money is to prop up the value of these banks. And the stability of the Chinese banking system has been cast into further doubt, again, because of the way they financed the stimulus. A lot of wasteful spending was had. And this is why you're also getting government buying up now the shares of these banks on the stock market to shore up their value. So I think the bottom line is the Chinese have a potential banking crisis, as most transition economies from central planning do. And
we'll look at that dread prospect in a minute, Linda. Does it? Some of the fine Chinese porcelain is translucent. Are any of the Chinese banks transparent?
Oh, I don't think they're transparent at all. Just picking up on your point about the bad debts, the amount in total of the previous round of stimulus and financing, which just came from the 1990s, was about $800 billion of bad debts.
Now, I'm just going to jot that down here.
With the zeros. But the problem is that what they did with this, which is what Linda was alluding to, was quite remarkable. For instance, ICBC set up a vehicle called Hurong. I may have got the pronunciation wrong, but it means prosperity of China. Now, what it has is it bought all the bad loans from ICBC, and on the other side, the government guaranteed Hurong's debt. So they went and raised, wait for it, $45 billion to actually finance what is basically a portfolio of bad debts. Now, that actually matured this, I think, last year, towards the end of last year. And I asked somebody what was happening with the Hurong bonds. They said, oh, nothing. We're just going to basically get the people who bought the bonds to buy them again. And I said, why? Because they're owned by other state-owned enterprises. But I think the important thing is not the actual shuffleboard that gets played. It's just the fact that because of the nature of the Chinese economy with state-owned companies, it's really robbing Peter to pay Paul, because basically both ends are actually owned. But coming back to your point about political interference, it's actually fascinating, because as Linda also said, there's a minority of foreign shareholders. And they're getting dudded in this, because this all this shuffling that takes place, it does not actually advantage them. And to give you some idea of how these banks are now used, they're used for what are known as the princelings. These are the families of the major political leaders who have all been put into strategic positions to find them little sinecures, basically. And the whole way they're shuffled is political. To give you some idea of this, HSBC, which is the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, owns a stake in the Bank of Communications, which is one of the largest banks. Firstly, they didn't get any board representation, which annoyed them enormously. But then they found that the chief executive they liked was suddenly shuffled out of the Bank of Communications with no consultation with HSBC, which owns 20% of the bank, and somebody else was put in. And they just rotate them around due to political exigencies. So to come back to your fundamental point of transparency, well, this is like Chinese porcelain. You can't see through it.
Linda, tell us about the possible catastrophe that awaits us all.
There is the prospect, I think, that China could have a banking crisis. I think this prospect has been heightened by the accumulation of allegedly bad debts from the stimulus. And I say allegedly because the banks are so opaque, it's actually very hard to know what their balance sheets really hold. An estimated 23% of their lending to local governments, which were charged with implementing the state-owned banks financed part of the stimulus, are assumed to be bad. So if you take that as a quarter of this year and last year's stimulus together, that's the equivalent of saying that that's about half a trillion dollars worth of loans have gone bad, and that is pretty substantial. So I think, though, probably the caveat here is there are still, as has been said, some shuffling of the bad debts from within the state system. But I think what is a problem now is the Chinese very much need to liberalize their capital account, meaning they need to adjust in this domestic liquidity, and they can't do it if the banks are so weak, because most sensible savers will want to diversify their deposits. And if the deposit base of the bank goes, then the banks may well find themselves in a serious liquidity crisis, because right now they're being underpinned by $6 trillion worth of deposits in the Chinese banking system. So I think there are real risks on the horizon for China as a result.
Now, Das, a last question to you. Clearly, we've got to dig up the rest of Australia and ship it out as fast as possible, don't we? How long have we got?
Oh, I think you've got another couple of years at least. But I think coming back to that shipping out, I think there's two things that went on. Certainly, the Chinese splurged in terms of their fiscal stimulus package, the bank lending, and they built everything. But there's also a strategic element in the minerals purchases from Australia. And that was the Chinese are in the process of shifting their reserves. So they were stockpiling lots and lots of resources simply because they are very disillusioned with US dollar investments, with euro-denominated investments, and now they're trying to diversify into yen, which pays interest, which you have to have an electron microscope to detect. So they were trying to basically try to stockpile lots of things. And the other thing that they were trying to do was buy up all sorts of mineral companies. So if you're an Australian miner looking for equity injections from China, or a mining company trying to export to China, you better do it soon. And the cleverest person here was actually Marius Kloppers from BHP. And he's a very smart guy, and he realized that this wasn't going to go on forever. And what most people didn't detect in actually changing the pricing mechanism for iron ore, because he shifted from long-term contracts to short-term contracts, because he knew the short-term contract prices were much higher, and he knew this boom wasn't going to last forever, and he wanted to basically take as much profit out of it as quickly as possible.
My clever guests, Sajid Das, LNL regular, and Linda Yu, fellow in economics at Oxford Uni and senior fellow at the London Business School. Thank you both. Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, etc.